From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now, and we're tracking Hurricane Michael, now a massive Category 4 storm that will slam this afternoon into Florida's Gulf Coast. Michael will be the strongest recorded storm ever to make landfall on the Florida Panhandle. And in the historic town of St. Marks, a mandatory evacuation order is in effect, but resident Bernard Sessions is staying.
Well, when they said it was a Category 4, I've never been in one, but I told them last night, her son come in and said, it's a Category 4. And I said, if y'all want to leave, go ahead. I'm going to stay. And she goes, no, you're going to stay. I'm going to stay.
All right. NPR's Greg Allen joins us now from Tallahassee. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Peter.
And I know you're just back from St. Mark's, right there on the coast where we heard Bernard Sessions. What are conditions like there?
Well, you know, when we were there, it was an hour or two ago, and it was already seeing flooding. This is before the storm had actually, you know, come close to the shore. It was pushing water ahead of it. You know, nearly everyone had left town, but as Bernard Sessions said, he was there with his friend Katrina Hurley. He has a shop and a garage there at the marina. He's not staying there. He's out at his house a little bit further out inland. But they tried to get him to evacuate. He wouldn't. But he said even his shop, it rain, floods even in heavy rain, so he's expecting the worst. But he's going to, you know, stick it out with his food supplies and his generator.
Now, when you talk to him and other people in that area, do they get the sense, really, of how intense this storm is going to be?
Oh, I think so. I mean, you know, people make their own judgments about this, about whether they're going to evacuate or not. But I don't think too many people at this point can claim ignorance about what a Category 4 storm means. You know, if you're not right at the coast, what they really worry about here is a storm surge, which is going to be 9 to 14 feet in some places. And I think people who live close enough to the shore that is going to be a concern are mostly gone, you know. I think it would be a rare person that would stay in that situation. What's going to happen, you're going to see this extensive flooding in coastal areas all along the panhandle. Also, you've got these high winds are concentrated around an inner eye wall that's going to be like almost like a tornado coming through about over a 4 or 5 mile square region. So that's what people are worried about here. If you're not in that inner eye wall area, you know, but on that one, there's no way to know unless it comes ashore where you are. So that's where people are taking the risk. If they stay in an area that has mandatory evacuation, you don't know where it's really going to come ashore and how strong the winds are going to be, you know. And they're talking about tropical storm force winds 175 miles from the center. That'll be a threat not just to that area, but for this all area, where we're likely to see, you know, widespread power outages.
I was just going to ask you about that. There are likely to be a lot of power outages. Have those started yet?
Yes, we're getting reports. I think it's up to 30,000 statewide. A lot of them are concentrated along the Panhandle coastal area where the storm is just preparing to come ashore. You know, it's just miles offshore now in the area around Mexico Beach out by Panama City, Florida. And so that's where the power outages are clustered now. But you know that they're going to grow as the storm moves inland and knocks down trees and then power lines.
Where will you be riding the storm out?
Well, we're here in Tallahassee, and things are, right now, we're getting some pretty significant gusts, kind of surprising. It's been raining pretty steadily. We've had bands coming through all morning. You know, rain is not going to be as much of a problem here, and this threat of inland flash flooding, which we saw in Florence, you know, up in North Carolina, that they don't expect to be such much of the case here because the storm is moving so fast. It'll maybe drop 4 to 8 inches of rain and should be out of Florida by the end of the day. But the downside of that is that when it hits southern Georgia by late today, it's going to still be a hurricane strength, is what they're saying. So southern Georgia, I don't know when the last time they saw hurricane strength winds, but they could be getting them later today.
All right. NPR's Greg Allen in Tallahassee. Greg, stay safe. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, President Trump is receiving updates on Hurricane Michael. In the Oval Office this afternoon, Trump asked FEMA Administrator Brock Long about the storm.
So they're reporting that this is one of the most powerful hurricanes ever to hit our country. Is that actually a fact?
Well, you know, so for in this area, this would be the most intense hurricane that struck this area since 1851, if I remember correctly.
The storm is hitting the Florida Panhandle in the final weeks of campaigning in tight races for governor and Senate in Florida. Our political strategists are with us now, Democratic strategist Jamal Simmons and Republican strategist Alice Stewart. Welcome to both of you, and let's get right to it. Florida Governor Rick Scott is in a dead heat in a Senate race against incumbent Democrat Senator Bill Nelson. Here's Governor Scott this morning.
Along our coast, communities are going to see unimaginable devastation. think about the devastation we've seen before with storms like Hurricane Irma.
Alice, what does this storm do to the race?
This puts a tremendous emphasis on certainly emergency responders, but it shows the true leadership of Governor Scott. He has been there for residents of Florida throughout many crises, whether it's man-made or a natural disaster, and he is showing real leadership, and you have the opportunity to do so as governor. We have heard from Senator Nelson with regard to what he is able to do, but this shows Governor Scott and his concern and compassion for the people of Florida. I've worked in Savannah and covered hurricanes there as a reporter, and Fran and Bertha, and the urgency that we're hearing from Governor Scott in terms of the time for you to evacuate is over. It is now time to bunker down and brace for the worst. He is serious. He means it. But at the same time, people in Florida can know that once this does happen, he will be there to provide all of the statewide and federal assistance that he can possibly get his hands on to help the people there. And that is it's a sign of the kind of leadership that he has now as governor and would do as senator.
Jamal, the other big race in Florida is the governor's race to replace Scott. And one of the people running in that race is Andrew Gillum, who's a Democrat who happens also to be the mayor of Tallahassee, where this storm is going to go. He was criticized for power losses in Tallahassee during Hurricane Hermine 2 years ago. Here he is on the Weather Channel.
My city was not practiced at dealing with hurricanes for about 30 years prior to Hurricane Hermine. And so just yesterday, we convened a whole range of neighborhood leaders, letting them know and charging them with the responsibility of going and checking on their most vulnerable.
Jamal, what do you think that this storm is doing to this race and the Scott Nelson race?
Well, first of all, I assume all the candidates share the same concern about the residents who are going to be in jeopardy in the middle of this storm. And so their first priority, I'm certain, is to make sure those residents are okay. For Andrew Gillum, he's kind of got the same situation as Governor Scott. He's got the ability to really show people his leadership, show people the way he's going to manage a crisis. And in a very intimate, real way, people will see him being a leader in the course of this race. This is something that the dynamic of Florida is very interesting, because even Democrats who I talk to on the state say, you know, Senator Nelson is having some trouble. He's an insider while Scott is kind of trying to take him on. And Senator Nelson is not really doing the same kind of campaign work to go out and get the new Democrats that Andrew Gillum is bringing into the race and try to appeal to them. Mm-hmm. I think the Nelson campaign thinks those Democrats will vote for him automatically. The people on the ground say, not so fast. You got to go get them. So both the Scott and the Gillum campaigns have the opportunity to really show their muscle during this storm.
It's funny because there are so many other issues that these people have been campaigning on all along. And now this storm could really change the dynamics of the race, Alice.
Certainly. And Governor Scott, when he ran for governor in 2010, when I worked for him, he had three priorities. It was jobs, jobs, and jobs. And he said that once. He said it 1,000 times. And that is what he's been able to provide for the people of Florida and has a good record on that. But also what he has done, speaking of natural disasters, the hurricane that hit Puerto Rico, a lot of those residents did come into Florida and are, whether they're taking up residency or they're spending time there, Governor Scott has done a tremendous job of making them welcome, providing the resources that they need, and that will go a long way to not just providing for the people there, but the Hispanic community that is so critical to that vote in the Senate race. So his ability to provide for people, everyday citizens of Florida, but also stepping up to the plate, not just with compassion, but with the resources necessary in a natural disaster, goes a long way to show what kind of leader he would be.
The crass political operative in me has one more thing to say, which is that the path of the storm probably is more hurtful to the Scott campaign, just because those are more Republican parts of the state that are going to be impacted. And those citizens are going to be very preoccupied by that. I'm also hearing, which is very tough, the DeSantis campaign launched a negative ad today on the Gillum campaign, which just seems to me to be very tone deaf to go after your political opponent with new advertising while so many residents have their lives hanging in the balance.
Okay, just in the minute that we have left here. Sorry, Alice, let me just get to one other thing, because it's important too, which is Mitch McConnell is calling the people who have been protesting about Kavanaugh an angry mob. And it brings us back to the Tea Party, which came to power after doing the same kinds of things at town hall meetings in 2010 during the debate over Obamacare. Jamal, is it the same thing?
Oh, I do think it is the same thing. And not only that, McConnell called the attacks on Judge Kavanaugh as coming from a mob when there were just people standing outside, you know, voicing their opinions and being arrested in peaceful protest. But the people inside of a political rally shouting, lock her up, to a political opponent while the president of the United States smiled in reaction. That's not a mob.
Let me just say this. The Tea Partiers never went into private restaurants and chased senators out of restaurants while they're on their private time. And what we're seeing these protesters in the Kavanaugh situation chasing out Senator Cruz, banging on the doors of the Supreme Court, right, and chasing senators down the hall, that is mob-like mentality.
Okay. Got to leave it there. Alice Stewart and Jamal Simmons, thank you. I'm broadcasting today from Southern California as part of our election road trip. There are four competitive congressional races in Orange County, according to the Cook Political Report. One of them is a seat being vacated by longtime Republican Congressman Daryl Issa, who just barely won his last reelection. The two people running to replace him in the 49th district are Democrat Mike Levin and Republican Diane Harkey. We met up with both of them, starting with Harkey, who was drinking coffee at a Harborside restaurant in Dana Point. She used to serve in the state assembly and currently serves on a state tax board. I asked her why she wanted to run.
I'm running, quite honestly, to end some of this dysfunction we have in D.C. I mean, you know, all the resist and movements coming out of California have really hurt us. You know, there's a tax reform bill where it did well for us in the long run on the business community, but we could have gotten a better deal had we had some people at the table. I do think that, you know, we have a lot of issues with regard to immigration that we need to get resolved. And it could be resolved if people were willing to work together. And there's also the job creation. The opportunity in this district is amazing with the military contracting and the biotech biomed. That is the engine of growth here. Our biggest problem right now is the workforce. We have 3.5% unemployment, and we can't get qualified help. And it's hard to get people to come to California because of the high cost of living and taxation.
Do you think that Daryl Issa was part of that dysfunction in Washington?
Daryl and I have totally different approaches to governing. I'm more of a consensus builder. I worked across the aisle in California many times. I was in the minority party. And I was the first Republican chair of the board in 15 years, which was unusual.
How closely aligned are you with President Trump? Because you do have his endorsement.
Well, there's a lot that I like on the economic front. I like a lot on the economic front. I'm not a fan of the approach. He's kind of got the good cop, bad cop in reverse. Generally, the elected person is the softer touch. But he's kind of frontal, and I think it makes it difficult to people understand, I think, in this district, because we're not used to that kind of approach. But I think the results he's gotten on the budget tax reform has really helped this district, helped this state.
Where do you disagree with Trump?
Well, I would have liked to have seen... a little bit more provision for California in our tax reform on the salt treatment, but that really wasn't him. That was the Congress. I think that I think more in the mannerisms, and also I'm not for offshore drilling. I think California has a beautiful coastline. We don't want that. The health care, we have to do something about the health care. Health care right now in California is okay, but Medicaid funding that we've accepted a lot of is driving providers out of the market because it's the state is pulling back on the reimbursement rates. Very, very difficult. So some people, the ACA actually worked pretty well in California because we've got a huge population, but there and again, we were seeing providers drop out of the market. So there's a lot of things to be worked on in healthcare.
What about what we just saw with Brett Kavanaugh? How do you feel about how the Senate handled his confirmation?
I thought it was hardcore politics. I didn't like it. It should have all been vetted pre-hearing. The United States, the people of this country should not have been dragged into that. I don't think it did anything to unite us. It created a lot of chaos and dysfunction.
One of the things that some voters know about you here in Orange County is that your husband was caught up in a Ponzi scheme. What do you want people to know about that? And do you think that they should be judging you on that at all?
Number one, that's a lie. There was no Ponzi scheme. So I want to set the record clear. There were allegations in the litigation from 2009 that declared everything. It was civil. It was never a criminal litigation. It was a civil litigation where you can throw anything against the wall and try to make it stick. And it went through a jury trial. So I really do believe that it's been misrepresented. And politicians, when they have no record to run on, frequently like to dig up old filings. This was a huge litigation, but I was cleared in 2013.
Do you think that that's hurting you, though, in this race?
Oh, well, if you can't defend yourself, it does. But I've got the people actually, you know, are asking about it now. And I'm explaining it. It's on my website. I tell the whole story. I tell what happened. It was 2008. Anybody involved in real estate understands the problems in 2008. The banks folded, properties were seized. It was miserable. And Mr. Levin worked for Countrywide, and he says there's an excuse for foreclosing on people, but he was a brand new attorney in a group, and they give the brand new guys these kind of dirty jobs to do.
What do you think the biggest issue is for voters in this district this year?
I think the dysfunction in D.C. You know, the resist, the thought of impeachment hearings, and all this chaos going on. People don't want politics. They want some results.
Diane Harkey, Republican running for Congress here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Harkey's opponent is the guy she was just talking about, a lawyer and first-time candidate, Mike Levin. We met him at his campaign office in San Clemente, and I asked him why he's running.
Well, for the last 2 decades, I've been involved in a variety of political campaigns. I've never felt compelled to run before myself after having been very involved in the 2016 election to help Secretary Clinton. And after seeing that result, my wife and I both decided what good is our background, our experience, our education, our relationships, the values that we have, the values that we want to share with our own children. If we don't stand up and try to do something for our country right now.
How much of an uphill climb is it for you as a Democrat running in Orange County and part of San Diego County?
Well, the good news is that in the primary on June 5th, 51.5% of the vote went to the Democratic candidates. So the momentum is on our side. President Trump's approval rating in our district is right around 40%. People are ready for new leadership.
Do you want to see President Trump impeached?
I'm not running on an impeachment platform. I do want to get to the truth. I want to see justice, and I want to see an investigation by Mr. Mueller that is not politicized. What we have seen with Devin Nunes as chair of the House Intelligence Committee is the withholding of relevant testimony and information. And, you know, the other side, you know, they're making us to be some angry mob, where they're saying, you know, don't give matches to an arsonist. Couldn't be further from the truth. We care about our country. We care about the rule of law. There cannot be one set of rules for the President of the United States and one set of rules for everyone else. That's not how our founders, created this democratic republic that we live in. Our Constitution still matters.
You bring up the line about the angry mob. How much do you think that what just happened with Brett Kavanaugh has changed the dynamics of your race? Has it energized Republicans more or energized Democrats more than they were before?
Well, I have no idea. All I know is that, yesterday, day before, we had an extraordinary number of volunteers, more than we'd ever seen. And I don't know how much of that was related to now Justice Kavanaugh or not. But what I can tell you is that we are doing everything we can to take nothing for granted over the last month of this campaign. We are going to just do an incredible amount of work, and I won't predict anything other than that. We will outwork the other side.
We asked your opponent, Diane Harkey, about something that's been dogging her campaign, which is that her husband had to pay a penalty for being involved in a Ponzi scheme. She said that's a lie. What do you think?
I think the victims deserve to be heard, and the facts are very simple. Her husband and Point Center Financial was found by both a jury as well as a judge and then an appellate court to be a Ponzi scheme, to be financial fraud. And dozens of seniors were defrauded out of millions and millions of dollars. And her husband or ex-husband, they have not paid nearly enough to those victims.
She also, in her answer to our question about that, tried to connect you to Countrywide, which was responsible for a lot of foreclosures. I've seen that on your website you say, I was just a junior lawyer working for Bank of America, which owned Countrywide, and I had nothing to do with that.
Not at all. She's tried to create false equivalence between the serious misconduct of her husband. We're talking about major financial fraud. In my work as an attorney, I'm proud of my work as an attorney. I've tried to do the right thing. I've tried to stand up for people, and the record is on my side. In my case, there was a very unscrupulous attorney, a guy named Mitchell Roth, who was disbarred and had to pay over $1 million in restitution because he, too, was trying to defraud borrowers. And what we tried to do at the law firm that I worked at was try to dismiss fraudulent lawsuits in order to try to keep people in their homes.
What do you think is the number one issue for voters this year?
Well, there are a lot of important issues: jobs, the economy, health care, education, the environment, gun violence prevention. All of them are important. And I think as it pertains to jobs and the economy, we've got a great district that is really leading the way in biotechnology, life sciences, clean energy technology, information technology. We need supportive federal government where we're fully funding the research and development necessary to continue to grow those jobs. And also providing the support necessary to our public schools, our community colleges, our wonderful university at UC San Diego. I'm not going to be a partisan flamethrower. I want to be somebody who fights for our local community first and tries to get results.
Mike Levin, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
The two candidates running to replace Daryl Issa in the 49th Congressional District in California. We asked Daryl Issa if he wanted to join us. He declined.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
At one point today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 400 points as investors worry about rising interest rates. The news was even worse for an iconic American retailer. Shares of Sears dropped more than 35% today on news that the company is preparing to file for bankruptcy. Sears has a $134 million debt payment coming due on Monday. Claire Sebastian is CNN's business correspondent. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Peter.
So, tough day on Wall Street. What's behind those numbers?
Well, so it's a confluence of events, really, for the Dow today. Rising interest rates is leading a lot of people to kind of reprice the shares that they're invested in, particularly those that are seen as the riskiest, and those are the tech stocks. So that's where we're seeing the biggest losses at the moment. There's also fears around China. Many had been hoping that the administration would start to negotiate. That does not seem to be the case. So fears about a slowdown in that economy and ramping up of trade tensions also playing in. And of course, Sears is down now about 30%, which is really only about 20 cents on a share price. That's low. But but really, fears around bankruptcy is what's going on there.
Right. It appears to be on the verge. What are the chances that you see that it makes that debt payment and avoids bankruptcy?
It's hard to see how it would do that. Clearly, the CEO, Eddie Lampert, is trying to avoid bankruptcy at all costs. He unveiled a broad restructuring plan back in late September, which involves exchanging some of the company's debt for equity, selling off various assets, some of which he's offering to buy himself. But the board hasn't agreed to that yet. And now today we get this report from the Wall Street Journal that they've hired advisors, plus the fact that we know that they've added a restructuring expert to their board. That happened earlier this week. So it's really not looking good. And if you look at the share price today, that essentially represents the likelihood that shareholders see that they will have to file for bankruptcy.
The numbers are staggering long term. This company lost $11 billion since 2011. Sales sales are down 60%, regardless of what happens with bankruptcy. Is there any way that a retailer like Sears can recover from a situation that bad in a world where the retail industry has just changed so much?
Right. I think that's the crucial question. Obviously, there are different types of bankruptcy. If they file for Chapter 11, that means that the debt will be restructured and the company may survive in some form. But even if their debt gets on a more sustainable footing, that isn't going to change the environment in which this company has failed to thrive. There are various reasons for that. They missed an opportunity to become a player online. They never really invested enough in their stores as customers began to demand more of an in-store experience. So we've seen this before with retailers. Sometimes Chapter 11 buys them a bit of time. And like we saw with Toys R Us, eventually they have to liquidate. And sometimes they survive, but Sears is in a very difficult situation. And the news reporting around this, frankly, over the last weeks, months, and years has not helped the brand, and that will not help them survive long term.
A decade ago, the share price for Sears, $144 a share. Today, I looked at one point, it was just 37 cents. The giants do fall. This was a company that was once the biggest employer in America. It's amazing. Claire Sebastian, CNN's business correspondent, appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
I'm broadcasting from Southern California today as we continue our election road trip with less than a month to go before the midterms. Asian Americans are the fastest growing ethnic group in this state. They now make up more than 14% of the population, a slice of the pie that has tripled in size since 1980. And in Orange County, where there are four congressional races that the Cook Political Report labels competitive.
It's about 800,000 right now. We are over 20% of the county and third largest Asian American population in the nation.
Marianne Fu, executive director of the Orange County Asian and Pacific Islander Community Alliance, says the Asian Americans living here are people with roots in the Philippines, China, Korea, Vietnam, Japan, and more. That's been the case for decades. The difference now is a greater number of those people were born in the United States.
I'd say it's probably about 30 to 35% right now. 70% of the community is foreign-born, as according to the census. But you see more and more diversity here in Orange County, and you'll see more of a rise of second generation.
That's important because the politics of the generations can be completely different. Alex Kim is principal and CEO of Three Kings Public Affairs. He's Korean-American and a registered Republican who worked as a political consultant for Democrat James Hahn, the former mayor of Los Angeles, and Republican Arnold Schwarzenegger, the former governor of California.
The first generation tends to vote Republican, and my second generation friends are more on the Democratic side.
Why is that?
Maybe it's because of a little bit of rebellion. But at the same time, it's similar to how Cuban Americans, Vietnamese Americans come from a country that came from a lot of trauma, war, types of financial distress. The first generation tend to say why they vote Republicans, because they see the corruption of government, the distrust of government.
And why the second generation going more Democratic?
I think because of the American values, a lot of these Korean Americans that grew up in second generation tend to grow up in urban areas. And I think that's part of the process. And urban areas tend to focus more on progressive thinking than more the conservative suburban ideals.
Kim says one of the first issues on the minds of Asian American voters is immigration. He and others are concerned about President Trump's policies, family separation, and
chain migration, and the thought of eliminating that, because a lot of my relatives came here through chain migration. So, and the question of workforce and how a lot of the small businesses are immigrants come from that chain migration system. So it seems like Korean Americans, the first generation, still are more majority loyal to Trump, no matter what. They believe they came here legally, a majority of them, and they believe that what he's doing is fair for the country. But definitely my friends that lean more Democratic or liberal Republicans or progressive Republicans like myself have definitely some qualms about that key issue.
Many of the first-generation Asian immigrants here are small business owners, running nail salons, dry cleaners, restaurants. Kim says the Koreans often use Korean community banks because back in the day it was difficult for them to get loans from American banks. Then there are Vietnamese-American business owners like Tam and Sunny Nguyen. We met them at a cafe Sunny owns in an Orange County neighborhood called Little Saigon. Sunny told us the politics here are shifting.
It's definitely changing. I think, you know, you look at Generation 1, which is our parents, Tam and I, we're 1.5. And we grew up, we're not born here in the U.S., so we were in Vietnam, but we were raised in America. So we understand what it means to be an American, but we also understand our parents, where they came from. So we can relate to both sides, and because we can relate to both sides, we can see the differences, and it's a stark difference.
What do you mean by that?
Not just from a political standpoint, but how we do business. So speaking just for our business and how we do things, our parents always said, hey, you know what, they came from a country where you can't really trust the government. So stay away from it. So when we came over here, you see a lot of our business and families cash only. Hey, you know what? You don't want to stay. We have our own strategies, and we don't want to share best practices because that becomes very competitive as well. And that's why first generations, they're known to be very fragmented, right? And you don't want to collaborate. But we grew up in America, and you know, I worked in corporate America, and there's a lot of collaboration, and that's how we actually grew. And you know, being an American, you know, and having inclusivity, I think that's one of our reasons why we have grown, is because we do collaborate, and we're showing our first gen, our parents, that look, we work closely with the cities, we are sharing our best practices, we are actually sharing our best practices with other entrepreneurs, and they're getting better, but because we're doing that, we're able to work together. And that's one of the big stark differences from Generation 1 and Generation 2.
Outside the cafe in Little Saigon are political signs attached to a fence at a busy intersection. Nearly every candidate's name is Vietnamese. The only Asian American running for Congress this year in Orange County is 55-year-old Young Kim, a Korean American Republican who worked for the lawmaker she's trying to replace, Ed Royce.
When my family came to this country, we came legally. And not because we wanted handouts, but because we wanted the opportunity America provided to succeed on our own.
Young Kim, praised by the OC Register for her consistent record opposing tax increases and fighting for fiscal responsibility. Young Kim for Congress.
There hasn't been a Korean American in Congress since 1999. This year, three are running in November, says political consultant Alex Kim.
We have Young Kim, of course, locally here. We have Pearl Kim and also Andy Kim. And
Not related.
Let all you know, Kim is a very popular name of Korean Americans, and I think a quarter of us are Korean Kims, including myself.
Alex Kim says some Asian American voters will support a candidate like them, regardless of party. Even though he's a Republican, he's working with a Korean American Democrat running for office in Georgia.
As a Republican, I'm helping a Democrat because it's more not just about party, it's about also this connection, this ethnic connection. And having not a single Korean-American in Congress right now, I'd rather, it doesn't matter if they're Democrat or Republican, I would like to see a Korean-American on there to represent me up there.
We heard something similar from Vietnamese-American Tam Nguyen.
You know, I see myself, especially as a business owner of the community, as a Vietnamese-American first before being part of a party as a Republican or Democrat.
That sentiment, says Marianne Fu, is in part a reaction to the way many Asian Americans have been treated in this country as outsiders. She says they still face discrimination at the workplace, in education and housing.
Asian Americans, no matter how long they've been here, they get the question of, you know, where are you really from or where are you from? I'm fourth generation. My family's been here since 1861, and I still get it. Or things like your English is so good, and you know, where are you really, really from? What languages do you speak? And I have to really explain, only speak English or Spanish. You know, my family's been here for so long that it's those types of questions, we always get it. And so it makes people feel that they're not really accepted or they're not really American.
So what do you think that means for this upcoming election?
I think it's really important to show as Asian Americans how crucial we are to civic engagement and how important it is for us to vote and have a voice, but also how important it is to educate the general public about the issues that we find are of concern or that we feel are important, and so to really talk about our values.
All of that is to say that politicians from both parties have a lot to gain from these Asian American communities in Orange County.
Are politicians paying attention to Asian American voters, do you think?
I think they have to. And so I think those who haven't in the past are now. And I think many of the ones who are more savvy or have known how important the Asian American vote is and how we tend to vote as a block, and so I think they see the impact that can be made by really learning about the issues of concern.
Now, in the news generally, there have been a number of Asian countries that have been right at the center of what's going on. You've got the situation in North Korea. You've got the trade war now with China. How is that playing?
I think people, because of the other of their country of origin and seeing the issues that are affecting here or being discussed here in the U.S., I think that it makes people more interested in voting because they're really concerned about what's going to happen with trade, what's going to happen with the relationships with the home country. So you'll see more people participating.
Fu says don't be surprised if that changes the color of some Orange County congressional seats from red to blue.
One of the most colorful festivals of the Southwest is underway this week in New Mexico. The Albuquerque International Balloon Fiesta draws hundreds of hot air balloons and hundreds of thousands of spectators from around the world. And for Troy Bradley and his daughter Savannah, it's a family affair. They are both hot air balloon pilots and are flying in this year's event. Troy, Savannah, welcome to Here and Now. How's the flying in Albuquerque?
Excellent. Yeah, we had a beautiful flight this morning, so it's all going very well down here.
Good. Troy, I want to start with you. You're kind of famous in this world. You've set some records. You're also a member of the U.S. Ballooning Hall of Fame, and you come from a long line of hot air balloonists. How did the Bradley family get involved?
So the original pilot in the family was my grandfather. He was one of the first balloonists in Colorado. So I was fortunate enough to grow up flying balloons with him and was able to start at a young age. It is an expensive hobby, so it's not something that every child can necessarily start with. So fortunately, my grandfather was a pilot, drug me around to a lot of balloon rallies when I was young, and I caught the bug and said I wanted to learn to fly. And so I was able to get my private pilot certificate right after my 16th birthday. I was scheduled to go for my check ride on my 16th birthday. It was 8 days after that the examiner was actually available and the weather cooperated. So that's when I was able to get my pilot certificate. So I'm 54.
Is that how old you have to be, 16, to fly a balloon?
For a private pilot certificate, yes. So you can be a student pilot prior to that. And actually, my son, Bobby, was the youngest person in the world to solo in a hot air balloon at age 9, but he did it in an ultralight balloon. So there's no pilot certification or age requirements for an ultralight.
So it's a family affair. Savannah, what about you? Do you always know you wanted to join in the family business?
No, actually. When I was little, I had no desire to become a pilot. And I was just happy being a proud member of the ground crew and just helping out wherever I could. But something clicked when I was 13 and I just kind of decided, you know what, like I'm going to start my training. And I soloed on my 14th birthday and got my license on my 16th birthday.
Wow. One of the things I love about the Albuquerque Fiesta is the pictures of all those balloons just hanging in the air. They're so colorful. They're beautiful. What's your balloon look like this year?
The balloon that I'm flying actually is a beautiful balloon with orange, red, and yellow colors, and it has the Zia symbol, which is the state symbol for New Mexico on the equator on two sides. So it definitely stands out. It's a passenger ride balloon, so I'm carrying 12 passengers every morning with me. And this is my 40th Fiesta that I've attended. I've flown 37 of them, and I'm still in awe every single time. It's a beautiful sight out there.
It is breathtaking. Savannah, what's your balloon look like?
My balloon is black on the bottom with the rainbow colors coming down from the top. And it's a balloon that holds about 4 people. And it's amazing. And this is my 3rd year in Fiesta, but I've seen it every year of my life and I love it.
Savannah, we heard how your dad is this experienced, sort of celebrated pilot. What's it like to have him as your guide? Has he given you tips for flying over the years?
Definitely. I actually, funny enough, I didn't want to learn how to fly from my dad because as great as he is, he's my dad.
You didn't want him telling you what to do. It's like, do your homework, fly your balloon.
Yeah, so I had a different instructor, but now, especially as I'm becoming a more experienced pilot, he's been a very, very great mentor and helped me to work towards the things I want to accomplish.
Troy, I'm sure you're very comfortable up there in the sky, but do you worry about your daughter up in a balloon?
Of course, because it's still my daughter. So as accomplished as she is, and I know how good of a pilot she is, I still require her after every landing to give me a call and let me know that she's down and safe. Yeah. So yeah, I'm still dad for sure.
What are the risks up there so high in the sky?
The risks are nominal, provided that you're really paying attention. It's like any other form of aviation. The number of accidents that happen are very rare and it's infrequent. However, when they do, they can have some dire consequences. So the real risks that are out there and are mitigated by, you know, good calls on the field before you ever take off. So it's really pilot judgment and making sure that the pilot's picking a good day to fly.
Well, there are some changes to the Fiesta this year. One drone will be allowed to fly with the balloons to take pictures, and there have been some concerns by local pilots, maybe you're one of them, about not having enough places to land because the area around Albuquerque is becoming more developed. What about that? Have you noticed any big changes to your sport?
Oh, the Albuquerque area has definitely changed dramatically. Like when I started flying, the entire north part of Albuquerque was not built up into anything. It was still open fields. And now we're really, truly flying in a congested area every single flight. Mm. So, but the city of Albuquerque is very, very balloon friendly. So the city itself designates that basically any school, park, golf course, anything that is city owned is open and welcoming to balloonists.
That's Troy Bradley and his daughter Savannah, who are hot air balloon pilots flying in the 47th Albuquerque International Balloon Fiesta. Thanks to you both. Have fun out there.
Well, thank you very much, and hope to see you out here someday, and we'll take you for a ride.
And Jeremy, it really is my dream to take Troy up on that
Me
offer.
Too.
I would love to go in one of those balloons. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. I was supposed to take a balloon ride earlier this year in Illinois.
Oh, no.
But it was too windy. Next time.
Safety first.